The final verse of that hymn really is remarkable, and the more I mature as a believer, the truer I find it to be. Jesus, our only joy, be thou, as thou our prize wilt be. In thee be all our glory now and through eternity. There are many things in life which bring us joy, which make us happy, which from which we derive pleasure. And yet Jesus, our only joy, be thou. I'd like to speak this evening, not on a particular passage and go through it, but on the theme of joy. And it is one to which I would like to return. I have in front of me two pieces of paper with a number of Bible verses written on them, all from the Old Testament, about joy. And there is a feeling among some people that, well, the Old Testament, that's very heavy and austere, but the New Testament is full of joy and peace and love. Well, the New interprets the Old and the Old the New. The Gospel is found in both. And in that reading from 1 Thessalonians of chapter 5 and verse 16, we have that text, rejoice evermore. Now that is a hard verse, very simple to read. Later on it says, in everything, give thanks. That is also easier to read than it is to do. There are some things for which I am not naturally inclined to be thankful. I remember back in 2015, you can see how this event is seared onto my mind. My car broke down in Thornton in Craven. I still drive past the spot to this day and shudder. It wasn't a big deal. The car broke down. The repairman towed me away, and I had a very large bill. And I remember, yes, I remember thinking, do I really have to give thanks for this? Now I thought, you know, maybe there is some good in it. Maybe the guy who towed it away, you know, he was feeling a bit lonely, or maybe I was to share the gospel with him. I did try. I don't think he was terribly interested. But if I found it hard to give thanks for that event, and no discernible good came from it, by the way, I'm not sure either that I could rejoice at that time. And yet Paul says, rejoice evermore. Again, in Philippians chapter 4, he says, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. But the clue there is rejoice in the Lord always. If I was rejoicing in a car that I had and it never broke down, the time will come surely when it will break down. And therefore, the source of my joy goes up in smoke and I stop being joyful. If, however, my joy is based upon the changeless one, who yesterday, today and forever, never alters, doesn't think better of it, doesn't have a change of character. If my joy is based upon him and his goodness towards me, it means I can give thanks in everything and I can rejoice forevermore because he is the source of my joy. Jesus, our only joy be thou, as thou our prize wilt be, in thee be all our glory now and through eternity. And I sometimes point out, I'm not sure entirely whether this point can be made from scripture, but joy, having joy in the Lord is not just an emotion. Emotions come and go. We have good days, we have bad days, and our expressions often give that away. But we can rejoice in the Lord even in the shadow, even in the dark times. This morning we looked at the Lord's message to Smyrna, and they had some terrible days ahead. The text does not tell them to be joyful, but when it talked about the wreath the crown waiting for them. How could that not result in joy? So a church, possibly quite literally, facing the executioner's block, and yet they had something worth waiting for. Well, let me consider a few reasons to be joyful from the Hebrew scriptures. I will be jumping around. Try and follow me if you can. I've just got a number of reasons why we can and should be joyful in the Lord. And in Deuteronomy chapter 16, the reason given for God's people to be joyful is for his wonderful provision. Chapter 16 and verse 13. You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days, when you have gathered from your threshing floor and from your winepress. And you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant and your female servant, and the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, who are within your gates. 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast to the Lord your God, in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in the work of your hands, so that you surely rejoice. And of course, we have here a picture of harvest. And the time is coming in this country chapel, as in many country chapels, when, you know, the front will be laden with vegetables and fruit, and we formally give thanks to God for the harvest. But here, God is telling his people, and you shall rejoice in your feasts. And it isn't merely rejoicing that we have good things to eat, but that is reason. Are we not blessed? And I refer now to God's common grace. All people on the planet have access to different types of food, different flavors, different colors, different textures. Is not food a blessing of God? He could have given us a pill. Every nutrient, every vitamin contained within it. And all you do is that you eat that once a day. But he gave us vegetables and fruits and meats that we might enjoy his provision, that we might look forward to that mealtime. And the Lord is telling the Hebrews in that 16th of Deuteronomy, everybody is to enjoy the feast. Everybody is to rejoice in God's abundant provision. The Levite, who has not his own land, the fatherless and the widow, the very poorest people, the stranger, the foreigner who does not belong there, they too will rejoice in the goodness of God and the bounty of his provision. The male servant and the female servant, they also will partake. This celebration of God's goodness and provision is not just for the rich or the landowner, but for the worker and those who are not even fit to work. Is it not also reassuring that he will continue to provide for us? I've already heard that people are stacking their cellars with baked beans and tinned soup because the economy is going to crash and the prices are going up. Well, let them. But I do know that he who feeds the sparrow won't let you go without. He will provide. And tonight you can rejoice not just in his provision, but in his role as your provider. Rejoice in the provider. God is a just God. in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Gentile and Israelites are told to rejoice together. Again, we sometimes think that the Old Testament was only concerned with the Hebrews, the Israelites, the Jews as they became. And the New Testament kind of opened it up to everyone. There is a degree of truth in that. And yet, even in the Old Testament, God clearly expresses his concern for those who are not physically his people. A great example, of course, being Jonah. Go to Nineveh. And yet, at first, it appears to be a rather terrifying passage in the 42nd verse of that 32nd chapter. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captives from the heads of the leaders of the enemy. Then in verse 43, rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people. Arrows drunk with blood? Is that really a cause for joy? Well, he says, he will avenge the blood of his servants and render vengeance to his adversaries. He will provide atonement for his land and his people. In one respect, the justice of God is terrifying because we know that we have sinned. And yet this morning, did we not partake of the bread and the wine? Does that not remind us that this terrifying, dreadful judge, who will judge the living and the dead, has also provided for our atonement? He has purchased our redemption before anybody in this room was born. He provided atonement for his land and his people. And yet there is also, that aside, something wonderfully beautiful about the justice of God. I think it was Augustine who said that crime is ugly, but punishment beautiful. Now, if you've ever been on the receiving end of a punishment, it doesn't seem very beautiful. I'm pretty sure that when I was enjoying my secondary education, that corporal punishment was already illegal. Nobody, though, had communicated that to my PE teacher. And I remember forgetting my PE kit and stumbling over backwards, such was the force of the blow. Suffice to say, I did not forget the PE kit again. I think I was more inclined to truant this, but anyway, there you go. But the fact is, there are lots of unsolved crimes in this country. Now, there is a list on Wikipedia of all the unsolved murders. It goes back to the 1500s. I'm pretty sure there is no department looking into them even now. All the witnesses are gone, the evidence dried up. But how many other unsolved crimes are there, long forgotten? Some of you will know if you drive down the lane, you go through Rimington, then towards Downham, there's a rather attractive bridge, Twizzle's Bridge or Rimington Bridge. That was the old county boundary. But I remember reading some dusty old book a few years ago. And there was a murder there in the 1400s that was never solved. And yet, our God is a God of justice, and whoever that victim, will not the judge of the earth do right? You might go to a human court and you might find that it is not fair. But will not the judge of the earth do right? Our God is righteous and fair. And that is a reason for us to rejoice. You look at the pagan gods, which were worshipped and believed in when the Bible was written, and they really are a horrible crew. Half of the Greek pantheon would be on the sex offenders register if they were around today. The Norse gods were a bunch of brutal thugs. You wouldn't want them anywhere near you. But unlike these disgusting deities of Canaan and Greece and Rome, the God of the Bible was a perfectly just and equitable God. Now, we expect our courts to be fair. We expect our government to have a basic level of integrity. But most of the folk who lived at the time of the Bible could only hope for such a thing. We can rejoice in the justice of God. We believers can go a step further and say, in the cross of Calvary, we can see the justice of God at work. The Father punished the Son, so that we who deserve all that punishment can be let off scot-free. Scot-free. Wow. The love and the justice of God. In 1 Samuel chapter 2, we have the prayer of Hannah. Hannah was barren, and having prayed, the Lord not only gave her a child, but gave her a child about whom we still speak. Samuel. Hannah prayed and said, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation." She could have said, "I rejoice in my pregnancy." She said, "I rejoice in the Lord." She might smile at her enemies, the other women who look down upon her, but no longer can. She might smile at them, but her joy comes from the Lord. And here is the Lord. He opened her womb. He intervened. He responded. The founding fathers of America, not all of them, but many of them, people like Franklin and Washington, they were what you call deists. Their religion was deism. And deism teaches that there is a God, and that God did make the world. But he's now effectively bored of it. So he kind of winds it up as he would a watch or a clock, and then disappeared to let it run itself. So therefore, there's no point praying to him, because even if he could hear, he doesn't care. And by all means, get together and have a good sing-song, but you're not singing for him, because he's not interested. But the God of the Bible is not the God of deism. The dispassionate deity with no emotion. He's a God who intervenes. He's a God who hears you when you pray. In fact, he doesn't just hear you when you pray. When we come together as a people, by his Spirit, he joins us. At every prayer meeting where there's not very many people there, the person who leads it will always feel duty-bound to say, "Well, where two or three are gathered, there he is also," and they do so quite rightly. But fancy that for a moment. The Lord Jesus, who is up in heaven, surrounded by myriads of angelic worshipper, deigns by his Spirit not just to hear and see what is going on in this chapel tonight, but he's with us. The deist God was beyond reach. The God of the Bible reaches down. He lifts us up. I'm not saying he answers every prayer the way we want it to be answered. We are not his employer, his manager. He does not come to us for advice or counsel. And yet he somehow, and I don't understand it, somehow he takes our wants and desires into account. And he delights to step in and step up. My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn, and that's an old Hebrew expression for my strength. Think about the horn of an animal. My strength is exalted in the Lord. Without him, I have no strength. I have a tiny little horn that's no good to anyone, but in him, my horn is exalted. It is magnified many times. I rejoice in your salvation. Even though she's grateful for having conceived, she's a godly woman, for she rejoices in salvation. Her ultimate need was not a baby. It was for God to save her. And sometimes when I hear non-believers saying that they prayed and they've asked for this and they've asked for that, and I kind of think, you know, all of that counts for nothing. What you need to get saved. You need to be in a right relationship with God. You can, you know, worry about the rest of the things sometime else. You're going to stand before God in judgment. And you can either pay for your own sin, or you can believe the gospel in which Christ paid it for you. My next passage is from the 6th chapter of 1 Samuel, a generation on, perhaps, from Hannah's prayer. And there was a time in Israel's history when the Ark of the Covenant fell into the hands of the Philistines. Now, the Ark of the Covenant was effectively a wooden box plated in gold, in which were the Ten Commandments and the staff and some bread. It was a symbol of the presence of God with his people. It was also a symbol of the gospel promise. The lid was called the mercy seat upon which blood was sprinkled. Gosh, what does that mean? We are saved by receiving God's mercy. The blood was shed that we might be brought back to God. So the Ark of the Covenant was a very precious and a very significant piece of kit. And yet God allowed it to be taken into Philistia. The Israelites had treated it perhaps as a talisman, a magical object. We can disobey God and live as we please, but if we drag the ark out when we go onto a battlefield, oh, we're bound to win because of the ark. And the ark only symbolized the presence of God. In that 6th chapter of 1 Samuel, God restores the ark to his people. Verse 12, then the cows headed straight for the road to Beth Shemesh and went along the highway, lowing as they went, and did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them to the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, and they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark and rejoiced to see it. Then the cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stood there. A large stone was there. So they split the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. Now, it doesn't end well for everybody, it must be said. But we're talking about joy tonight. But what do we have here? That symbol of the presence of God, the Philistines, well, they had enough of it because their idols kept falling over and various things went wrong and they got ill. It's a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. They found that. But the ark is returned to Israel. And they're busy reaping and going about their agricultural work. And they look up and there is the ark trundling over on the horizon. Perhaps flashing in the sun, the colour of the gold. And they rejoiced. Many Christians in their life, that there are times when they feel close to the Lord and there are times when perhaps they feel not so close. And let me assure you, on that occasion, it's never the Lord who moves away. I think last Sunday, looking at that first letter to the church in Ephesus, I think we sang Cowper's hymn, "Where is the blessedness I knew when I first saw the Lord? Where is that soul refreshing view of Jesus and his word?" I remember being very much challenged once by a preacher who said, if you can look back at a time in your Christian life when you were closer to the Lord then than you are now, you're a backslider. But the people rejoiced. Because the ark returned. And if you were as challenged by that claim as I was when I first heard it, the good news is that if you feel the Lord is far, you can rejoice tonight. Because you can be as close to him as ever you were. Nay, you can be closer still. He is the God who will have you back. He is the God who restores his presence to Israel. He is the God who is far more gracious than we are rebellious. He's more inclined to bring us back even than we are to wander off. I remember preaching through 1 Kings a few months ago, probably a few years ago as well. And in chapter 1 of that book, we have the coronation of Solomon, the anointing of Solomon. One of my favourite pieces of music is Zadok the Priest. And it's played at the British coronation. Now, I'm rather fond of our Queen. Hope she stays around a while longer. But there will be a coronation. And they'd better play it. Somebody will probably object. Zadok the Priest and Nathan the Prophet anointed Solomon king, and all the people rejoiced. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, you can go home on YouTube, you can play it. Wonderful piece of music. But again, we read of it in that 39th verse of that first chapter of 1 Kings. Then Zadok the priest took a horn of oil from the tabernacle and anointed Solomon. And they blew the horn, and all the people said, "Long live King Solomon." And all the people went up after him. And the people played the flutes and rejoiced with great joy, so that the earth seemed to split with their sounds. Now Adonijah and all the guests who were with him heard it as they finished eating. And then Joab heard the sound of the horn. He said, "Why is the city in such a noisy uproar?" What's going on here is that there are two kings of Israel. There's Adonijah and all the people celebrating his kingship. And then there's Solomon. And it was clear from the beginning, God had chosen Solomon. And the people are rejoicing at Solomon's anointing. Again, Hebrew kings were anointed with oil rather than crowned. Although British monarchs are also anointed before they are crowned. And it says, the people rejoiced with great joy. Why are they rejoicing with great joy? Well, if it was just a standard, let's proclaim the new king the king, I think they would have rejoiced. But here, they're rejoicing with great joy. Why? Because the true king has just been anointed. Oh, there's a party going on elsewhere. They're not quite so joyful. I think that when you live for King Jesus, who is the true king, in fact, he is the king of kings, anyone on the planet who wears a crown or sits behind a presidential desk, one day they will bow the knee to our King Jesus, whether they do so now or not. They will be held accountable to him. But there is something particularly joyful about knowing that we know the King of Kings and that he's coming back to reign. And there are governments around the world, perhaps we thought of them this morning, which claim a degree of sovereignty over people's lives to which they are not entitled. Indeed, there are people who have come, and there is one who is coming, who will claim to be God and demand worship from the people of the earth. But such worship will bring no one joy. When you bow the knee to King Jesus, you don't just rejoice, you rejoice with great joy. Because he is the monarch for whose service you were created. He is the king you were meant to serve. And when you become a Christian and you acknowledge his kingship, you rejoice with great joy. All sorts of things can go wrong. Life is not always very pleasant, is it? But so long as Christ is the king, and he's your king, you will rejoice. Yeah, you will rejoice with great joy. The penultimate point I would make, this time from 1 Chronicles chapter 29, and it talks about offering materials for building the temple. This time it's David who is king. And various people are contributing. Now David was not to build the temple. That was to be Solomon's task. But David took it upon himself to amass the materials with which it would be constructed. Verse 8 of chapter 29. And whoever had precious stones gave them to the treasury of the house of the Lord, into the hands of Jehiel the Gershonite. Then the people rejoiced, for they had offered willingly, because with a loyal heart they had offered willingly to the Lord, and King David also rejoiced greatly. The world tells you that when you are the recipient of the precious jewel, of the fancy new car, of the bonus, of that material wealth, when you receive it, then you can rejoice. But look at these people here. They are giving over their precious objects for the building of the temple, and in the giving, they are rejoicing. Why is it better to give than to receive? It's illogical. The more I have, the happier I will be. But that is the world's lie. The rich man can't sleep at night. He fears the state of his investments. The laboring man has no such trouble. there are camels passing through the eyes of needles before the rich man gets to heaven. The reason the people are rejoicing is that it is a privilege to give to the Lord. It is a privilege to serve him. To think that Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, eternal Emperor, chooses to use us to do his work. What a privilege. You know, if you buy a product from a shop and you see the Queen's coat of arms on it, it's called the Royal Warrant. That means that the royal household has been buying it for more than 3 years. And therefore, those companies are allowed to boast, the Queen is our regular customer. That basically allows the company to put the price up. Because other people will say, well, if it's good enough for the Queen of England, it's probably good enough for my breakfast table in Barnoldswick. So I too will buy it. But those companies consider it a great privilege to supply cornflakes to the Queen. But it's a greater privilege to be a servant of the King. To know that what you do, the money you give or the talent you use or the time you give him is for his glory and not your own. Then the people rejoiced, for they had offered willingly. Furthermore, we're told that King David also rejoiced. Might it be that when you give to the Lord, it gives him pleasure? And if you love him, surely that gives you pleasure as well. There is joy in serving the King. I see some believers, and I think they're genuine believers. And I'm not talking about anybody in this room, nor anybody who comes to this church. But I'll be honest with you. I have no idea what they're doing for the kingdom. Now, okay, let's do a disclaimer. They might be real prayer warriors behind closed doors. I doubt it. And I think they're missing out on so much. It's not a burden to serve the Lord. It's a royal privilege. And in so doing, we rejoice.